Well, last week we finished 1 Samuel, and we will now go right on to 2 Samuel. And of course, 1 Samuel ends with the death of Saul, and 2 Samuel will start with David getting that word. The first part of 2 Samuel here is going to be the process that David is going through to become king of Israel. So he'll start off in Hebron and first become king of Judah and then extend his reign over all the rest of Israel. Now, last time I ended by saying there's two different accounts of Saul's death, and we'll go ahead and get that second account tonight. Remember, the account that was in 1 Samuel is Saul asked his armor bearer to kill him, and his armor bearer would not. So Saul fell on his own sword. The armor bearer took his life after Saul was definitely dead. So Saul and his armor bearer both died. Now we're in 2 Samuel 1. After the death of Saul, when David had returned from striking down the Amalekites, David remained 2 days in Ziklag. Remember when he was up trying to join the Philistines, the Amalekites made a raid against his home base at Ziklag and took everybody. And so David went after them, struck them down, and recovered everybody and all their loot. So verse 2. And on the third day, behold, a man came from Saul's camp with his clothes torn and dirt on his head. And when he came to David, he fell to the ground and paid homage. David said to him, "Where do you come from?" And he said to him, "I have escaped from the camp of Israel." And David said to him, "How did it go? Tell me." And he answered, "The people fled from the battle, and also many of the people have fallen and are dead. And Saul and his son Jonathan are also dead." Then David said to the young man who told him, "How do you know that Saul and his son Jonathan are dead?" And the young man who told him said, "By chance, I happened to be on Mount Gilboa, and there was Saul leaning on his spear. And behold, the chariots and the horsemen were close upon him." Verse 7. "And when he looked behind him, he saw me and called to me. And I answered, 'Here I am.' And he said to me, 'Who are you?' And I answered him, 'I'm an Amalekite.' And he said to me, 'Stand beside me and kill me, for anguish has seized me, yet my life still lingers.' So I stood beside him and killed him, because I was sure he could not live after he had fallen. And I took the crown that was on his head and the armlet that was on his arm, and I have brought them here to my lord." Stop there. There's two possibilities here, at least. Possibility one is that this young man actually did kill Saul. That would contradict what we read in 1 Samuel. David clearly believes he did. It's also important to notice that he did see Saul dead because he's got Saul's crown and his arm bracelet with him. So the fact that he was a witness to a dead Saul, whether or not he was the one that facilitated that state, is important. Now, it's possible that this guy just came upon Saul's body, recognized who Saul was, and grabbed his crown and his armlet, and then beat feet back to David with the idea that he was going to be rewarded for telling David that his enemy is dead. I am sure that's probably what went through his mind, regardless of whether he was the one that actually killed Saul or not. David clearly believes that he's telling the truth. Verse 11 now. "Then David took hold of his clothes and tore them, and so did all the men who were with him. And they mourned and wept and fasted until evening for Saul and Jonathan his son, and for the people of the Lord and for the house of Israel, because they had fallen by the sword. And David said to the young man who told him, 'Where do you come from?' And he answered, 'I am the son of a sojourner and a Amalekite.' David said to him, 'How is it you are not afraid to put out your hand to destroy the Lord's anointed?' Then David called one of the young men and said, 'Go, execute him.' And he struck him down so that he died. And David said to him, 'Your blood be on your head, for your own mouth has testified against you, saying, I have killed the Lord's anointed.'" As I say, it's entirely possible that this Amalekite just happened upon Saul, picked up his signs of rank, and came to David. It's also possible that he's the one who did it. Several things that are interesting here. The first thing is David is now in the process of setting up the political atmosphere for himself to become king. The natural thing for David to have done was to say, "Oh, wow, you finished off my enemy. I now no longer have to fear Saul," and reward the guy. That would have been the natural thing to do. But doing that would have made him sort of a stench in the nostrils of Israel, because Israel had just lost a major battle, and they had just lost their king. And so for David to celebrate and reward the one who had slain Saul would be a politically bad maneuver on David's part. The other thing that is fascinating to me every time I read this is you remember Saul's downfall as king was his failure to deal with the Amalekites as God had told him. When God said, go wipe them all out, and he didn't do that, that's the thing that God said via Samuel, your kingdom will not last, I'm going to take it from you and give it to somebody else. So I think it's at least ironic that at the end of his life he is either killed or defiled by an Amalekite. I find that absolutely fascinating, that it was not a Moabite or an Ammonite or anybody else that found him. It was an Amalekite. So you've got Amalekites at both ends of his reign, and in both cases, they are not doing him any good. I find that more than a little bit ironic. And if you wanted to take an homiletic lesson from that, when God tells you to wipe somebody out, you better do it, because if you don't, they're going to come around and wipe you out later. Comment was, Yeshua says that we've got to mortify our own flesh. And it keeps coming back to get us. Yeah, sure, I would agree. Good comment. So now we're down to verse 17. And David lamented with this lamentation over Saul and Jonathan his son. And he said, it should be taught to the people of Judah. Behold, it is written in the book of Jasher. He said, your glory, O Israel, is slain on your high places, how the mighty have fallen. Tell it not in Gath, publish it not in the streets of Ascalon, lest the daughters of the Philistines rejoice, lest the daughters of the uncircumcised exult. Notice what David is doing. You know, David's a poet, wrote lots of the Psalms and so forth. He is composing a memorial hymn to Saul and Jonathan, and he is saying that it should be taught to the people of Judah. The idea here, obviously, is by honoring Saul, he is making a good move, and by telling the people of Judah, you should know this, he is making yet another politically astute move. And we're reading this a couple thousand years later, more than that, almost 3,000 years later. And looking at this, you can see the political moves that he's making. What I don't know, and don't have any opinion about, is whether he is doing this in a calculating manner or he's just a natural. One of these guys whose instinct is always just naturally right. One of the things we've seen about David up until now is people like him. He's popular. He puts together a gang of bandits in the south of Judah, and he gets all sorts of worthless people, and that's how they're described in Scripture, as worthless people, who show up and gather around him, and he becomes their leader, and he turns them into something useful. So he is a very gifted, charismatic leader. So when I'm remarking on all these astute political moves that he's making, don't necessarily read into that that he's the Joe Biden of Israel. Always got advisors and so forth, you know, having him make the right move and all that kind of stuff. That's not what I'm saying. I'm simply pointing out that he is very sure-footed when it comes to politics. The comment was that it seems to be instinctive, and you may be right. I'm not arguing with you at all. By the end of his reign, or well into his reign, he is going to prove, for example, that he is perfectly capable of committing adultery with another man's wife and then ordering that other man killed by sending him into a dangerous part of the battle. So he's certainly capable of Machiavellian moves. He also seems to be very sure-footed. So I'm not ascribing any motive to any of this. I'm simply making note of it as we read it. So we're now down to verse 21. You mountains of Gilboa, let there be no dew or rain upon you, nor fields of offerings. For there the shield of the mighty was defiled, the shield of Saul, not anointed with oil. What that may mean, probably does mean, you remember when Solomon builds a temple, he makes shields of gold and so forth. It's my understanding that the standard shield at that time was leather. Leather stretched over a wooden frame. So it had to be oiled in order to be useful and quit cracking and so forth. So the shield of Saul was not anointed with oil is a sad thing because he was depending on it, quote unquote. I mean, I don't know what the actual fight was about, but the whole point of a shield that's anointed with oil is it's ready to protect you, and it didn't. 22. From the blood of the slain, from the fat of the mighty, the bow of Jonathan turned not back, and the sword of Saul returned not empty. In other words, they were both valiant in war. Saul and Jonathan, beloved and lovely, in life and in death, they were not divided. They were swifter than eagles, they were stronger than lions. You, daughters of Israel, weep over Saul, who clothed you luxuriously in scarlet, who put ornaments of gold in your apparel. How the mighty have fallen in the midst of the battle. And he's obviously eulogizing Saul and reminding them of the successes that he had. Jonathan lies slain in your high places. I am distressed for you, my brother Jonathan. Very pleasant have you been to me. Your love to me was extraordinary, surpassing the love of women. How the mighty have fallen and the weapons of war perished. This kind of thing is going to stand him in good stead as he's going to try and unite all of Israel, which of course he'll succeed in doing. Chapter 2. After this, David inquired of the Lord, "Shall I go up into any of the cities of Judah?" The Lord said to him, "Go up." David said, "To which shall I go up?" And he said, "To Hebron." So David went up there, and his two wives also, Ahinoam of Jezreel and Abigail, the widow of Nabal of Carmel. And David brought up his men who were with him, every one with his household, and they lived in the towns of Hebron. And the men of Judah came, and they anointed David king over the house of Judah. Now, you remember in the end of 1 Samuel, David was raiding in southern Judah, and he was raiding people who were the enemies of Judah. Furthermore, when he went after the Amalekites and he chased them down after their raid in Ziklag, he was very careful to take a whole lot of the spoil and send it as presents up to the cities in Judah. So he's got a reputation now as a good warrior. He's got a reputation of taking care of his friends. He's got a reputation for being charismatic. So it's sort of a natural thing once the monarchy is destroyed, because Saul is dead now. Saul was the king over all Israel. Comment was, the king has died and he has no heir. That's not true. He does have an heir, and his heir is Ishbosheth, and we'll see that Abner, who is Saul's commanding general, is going to try and make of Ishbosheth a northern kingdom, if you will. The point is, everything is in disruption right now, and the men of Judah decide we want David as our leader. So at this point, he's king over Judah. You could also say that he is the tribal leader of Judah, because there's only one tribe. Maybe Judah and Simeon, because Simeon is incorporated into Judah. Halfway through verse 4. When they told David it was the men of Jabesh-Gilead who buried Saul, David sent messengers to the men of Jabesh-Gilead and said to them, "May you be blessed by the Lord because you have showed this loyalty to Saul, your Lord, and buried him. Now may the Lord show steadfast love and faithfulness to you, and I will do good to you because you have done this thing. Now therefore, let your hands be strong and be valiant. For Saul, your Lord, is dead, and the house of Judah has anointed me king over you." Again, very astute political move. Notice that he has said, Saul is dead, ... and I'm now king over Judah. He doesn't suggest that he be king over them. He simply congratulates them, says you did a wonderful thing, may you be totally blessed, and, oh, by the way, I'm king over Judah. So it's subtle, but really obvious, and he keeps doing this stuff. And don't get the impression that I'm being cynical about this. I'm not. Because Samuel has anointed him to be king over all Israel. So objectively speaking, it's not the case that he's sitting there power hungry and wringing his hands and looking greedily on the rest of Israel. God has told him, you're going to be king. And what he's doing is making very astute political moves that are going to bring that about. And this is another one of them. Verse 8. But Abner, the son of Ner, commander of Saul's army, took Ishbosheth, the son of Saul, and brought him over to Mahanaim. And he made him king over Gilead and the Asherites and Jezreel and Ephraim and Benjamin and all Israel. So we have the northern kingdom being set up. Ishbosheth, Saul's son, was 40 years old when he began to reign over Israel, and he reigned for 2 years. But the house of Judah followed David. And at the time that David was king in Hebron over the house of Judah was 7 years and 6 months. Mahanaim. It's where the Jabbok River comes from the east into the Jordan. It's a very rugged piece of terrain. It is the place where Jacob met his brother Esau. It's also the place where David will flee when his son runs him out of town. In other words, it is a traditional place where you get yourself set up if you are expecting to have to fight with unfavorable odds. So we see it over and over again figuring in the history of Israel. And that's because it's very rugged, very defensible, wooded. If somebody wants to stay in there, you have a hard time getting him out. And that's Abner's assessment of the situation, which is why he takes Ishbosheth there. And David has the same idea when he gets run out of Jerusalem. So verse 12. So Abner the son of Ner and the servants of Ishbosheth the son of Saul went out from Mahanaim to Gibeon. Gibeon is on the central ridge route. And Joab, this is the first of Joab, and we'll see lots of Joab. And Joab the son of Zeruiah and the servants of David went out and met them at the pool of Gibeon. And they sat down, one on the one side of the pool and the other on the other side of the pool. And Abner said to Joab, "Let the young men arise and compete before us." And Joab said, "Let them arise." Now, I have no idea what this is about. I know what's going to happen, obviously, but I'm not sure what Abner is expecting to have happen. But obviously what happens is a battle. I don't know that Abner was expecting that, but he may have been. I mean, that may have been old-timey Israel speak for let's fight. And that word, by the way, play, is the same word that is used in Genesis when Isaac is weaned and his brother Ishmael is playing with him. It's the same word. So this particular word in Hebrew is associated with bad stuff. Verse 15. Then they arose and passed over by number, 12 from Benjamin, and Ishbosheth the son of Saul, and 12 of the servants of David. And each caught his opponent by the head and thrust his sword in his opponent's side. So they fell down together. Therefore, the place is called Helkath Hazurim, which is in Gibeon. Now, I'm not sure who killed who. I'm not sure whether this was an intentional combat or that they got ambushed. They weren't expecting mortal combat, and so they got stabbed unaware. But the ones that prevail are Joab's, because Abner and his flock are going to flee, and Joab and his flock are going to follow after him. So I am obviously guessing here, but my guess is that Abner was expecting some sort of a competition in a game-like fashion. Joab was dead serious. But all I have is what's in front of me in Scripture, so I'm just speculating. 17. And the battle was very fierce that day, and Abner and the men of Israel were beaten before the servants of David. And the three sons of Zeruiah were there, Joab, Abishai, and Asahel. Now Asahel was swift of foot as a wild gazelle. And Asahel pursued Abner. And as he went, he turned neither to the right hand nor to the left from following Abner. Then Abner looked behind him and said, "Is that you, Asahel?" And he said, "It is I." And Abner said to him, "Turn aside to your right hand or to your left and seize one of the young men and take his spoil." But Asahel would not turn aside from following him. And Abner again said to Asahel, "Turn aside from following me. Why should I strike you to the ground? How then could I lift up my face to your brother Joab?" So the idea here is Abner still has visions of some kind of a negotiated deal. So he doesn't want to kill Asahel for fear that it's going to mess up the opportunity to come up with an alliance of some kind. 23. But he refused to turn aside. Therefore, Abner struck him in the stomach with the butt of his spear, so that the spear came out on his back. And he fell there and died where he was, and all who came to the place where Asahel had fallen and died stood still. We used to do bayonet training. Put a big knife on the end of your rifle, right? And your whole rifle at that point is a weapon. There are moves where you use the blade of the bayonet. There are also moves where you use the butt of the rifle. The butt of the rifle is not typically lethal because you do a vertical butt stroke and you're trying to catch the guy in the chin with the butt of your rifle and flatten him. Probably not fatal. So what Abner seems to be doing here is the old-time spear equivalent of a vertical butt stroke series where you just want to knock the little so-and-so out or down so that he can get away. He hits him so hard, it's like your rifle butt getting driven clear through the guy and kills him. I don't think Abner intended to kill him. I think it was just slap some sense into him so Abner could get away. I mean, if it had been lethal, he wouldn't have hit him with the butt of his spear. He just stuck the spear in him. And that basically stops things. 24. But Joab and Abishai pursued Abner. And as the sun was going down, they came to the hill of Ammah, which lies before Gaia, on the way to the wilderness of Gibeon. And the people of Benjamin gathered themselves together behind Abner and became one group and took their stand on the top of the hill. Then Abner called to Joab, "Shall the sword devour forever? Do you not know that the end will be bitter? How long will it be before you tell your people to turn from the pursuit of their brothers?" Get the situation. He's got the men of Benjamin with him. They are on top of a hill. So what they have is an energy advantage because they are gathered together in some kind of a combat formation on top of a hill, and Judah has got to fight its way up the hill. Fighting uphill is harder than fighting downhill. So they have gotten themselves into their best defensive position and said, "Now, are we going to stop this or not?" And of course, Joab thinks better of it. 27. And Joab said, "As God lives, if you had not spoken, surely the men would not have given up the pursuit of your brothers until the morning." So Joab blew the trumpet, and all the men stopped and pursued Israel no more, nor did they fight any more. And Abner and his men went all that night through the Arabah. The Arabah is the valley of the Dead Sea. And Abner and his men went all that night through the Arabah, and they crossed the Jordan, and marching the whole morning, they came to Mahanaim. Joab returned from the pursuit of Abner, and when he had gathered all the people together, they were missing from David's servants 19 men, besides Ashiel. But the servants of David had struck down of Benjamin 360 of Abner's men. So I am sort of getting the impression that that initial was an ambush, and they caught them unawares, and the men of Benjamin never did fully recover, so they lost a lot of men that day. 32. And they took up Ashiel and buried him in the tomb of his father, which is at Bethlehem. And Joab and his men marched all night, and the day broke upon them in Hebron. So that's the first encounter, and that's our first meeting with Joab. And you know that Joab, in addition to being a thug, is a power-hungry guy. And the last thing that you ever want to do is get between Joab and power. We're going to see that happening over and over again. And in fact, one of the things that will happen, of course, later on, when we have the incident with Bathsheba, is David is going to send a letter to Joab to put Uriah in the thick of the battle so he gets struck down. The only two people who know about that are David and Joab. Joab does what he says and sends back an ambiguous report. We had a battle and, oh, by the way, Uriah has died. And it's interesting because David never jerks Joab up short. And it's only as David is dying that he gives instructions to his son Solomon, "You need to kill Joab." David can't do it because Joab has got the goods on him. I would suggest he's probably got a letter squirreled away somewhere. So David is not able to completely control Joab because of that indiscretion. Chapter 3. There was a long war between the house of Saul and the house of David, and David was stronger and stronger while the house of Saul became weaker and weaker. And sons were born to David in Hebron. His firstborn was Amnon, of Ahinoam of Jezreel, his second Chilab of Abigail, the widow of Nabal of Carmel, the third Absalom, the son of Maacah, the daughter of Talmi, king of Geshur, and the fourth Adonijah, son of Haggith, and the fifth Shephatiah, the son of Abital, and the sixth Ithream of Eglah, David's wife. These were born to David at Hebron. Something to notice here. We're going to see Absalom again. We're also going to see Amnon again. Amnon's going to be the one that rapes his half-sister. But notice Absalom. Absalom, the son of Maacah, the daughter of Talmi, king of Geshur. So his mother is the daughter of one of the local kings. So she is raising her son with the expectation that he is going to be a king as well. And of course, he's the one with the long hair, and he's the one that runs David out of town and tries to do a coup. And David mourns for him when he dies, but the thing to take note of here is who his mother is. And his mother comes from a position of power, and she is grooming her son to assume a position of power as well. Abigail, for example, we met her, remember, in 1 Samuel, very bright woman, also apparently very decorative. But she is the wife of a sheep owner. She's not a power player, if you will. She didn't grow up in a court. Maacah, Absalom's mother, did grow up in a court. She's used to navigating the corridors of power, and she's used to playing the game. And we'll see that in her son. Verse 6. While there was war between the house of Saul and the house of David, Abner was making himself strong in the house of Saul. So Abner is running the house of Saul. Now Saul had a concubine whose name was Rizpah, the daughter of Ai. And Ishbosheth said to Abner, "Why have you gone into my father's concubine?" And we'll see this again, because when Absalom runs David out of town, the first thing he does is he takes David's concubines and he cohabits with them in full view of everybody in town. The idea being, I am now the stud here. So when Abner takes one of the concubines of Saul, Ishbosheth says, "Oh, what are we doing here? We're going to have a coup?" That's sort of the thing that's going through his mind. Verse 8, "Then Abner was very angry over the words of Ishbosheth and said, 'Am I a dog's head of Judah? To this day I keep showing steadfast love to the house of Saul your father, to his brothers and to his friends, and have not given you into the hand of David. And yet you charge me today with fault concerning a woman?'" Ishbosheth is not quite as smooth politically as David is. Verse 9. "God do so to Abner and more also, if I do not accomplish for David what the Lord has sworn to him, to transfer the kingdom from the house of Saul and set up the throne of David over Israel, over Judah, from Dan to Beersheba." And Ishbosheth could not answer Abner another word because he feared him. So Abner is the alpha dog in this. And when Ishbosheth said, "Wait a minute, why are you arrogating to yourself my father's concubine?" That sort of flips him over the edge. Verse 12, "And Abner sent messengers to David on his behalf, saying, 'To whom does the land belong? Make your covenant with me, and behold, my hand shall be with you to bring over all Israel to you.'" So he has discarded Ishbosheth. Because remember, Ishbosheth, being the son of Saul, has a certain amount of rightful claim, if you will, to succession to the throne. So Ishbosheth was Abner's legitimacy. He kept Ishbosheth set up, but Abner himself was the guy who was arrogating power. And in Abner's mind, Ishbosheth was just a figurehead. And given the way Ishbosheth reacts when Abner growls at him, it's entirely likely that he's just a figurehead. So Abner now gives up the pretense and he says, "Heck with this, let's just unite and I will get the northern kingdom for you and we'll unite everybody." And of course, Abner is of the opinion that he is going to be a very important guy in David's administration, which he would have been. Verse 13, "And he said, 'Good, I will make a covenant with you, but one thing I require of you, that is, you shall not see my face until you first bring Michal, Saul's daughter, when you come to see my face.'" So Michal, you remember, was given to David as a wife. And she, in fact, stood with David against her father and helped him escape. And she loved him. I mentioned at the time, it's the only instance in the Hebrew Bible where a woman is said to love a man. So David wants her back. 14. "Then David sent messengers to Ishbosheth, Saul's son, saying, 'Give me my wife, Michal, for whom I paid the bridal price of 100 foreskins of the Philistines.' And Ishbosheth sent and took her from her husband, Paltiel, the son of Laish. But her husband went after her, weeping after her, all the way to Bahurim. Then Abner said to him, 'Go, return.' And he returned." So Abner's saying, this is a political thing. She's no longer yours. As I'm very fond of saying, all little girls want to be princesses. Well, this is what happens to princesses. They are a commodity, if you will, in power politics. So in addition to all the furs and the jewels and people bowing down to you, you could get married off to the king of Silesia for peace in Poland or something. Verse 17. "And Abner conferred with the elders of Israel, saying, 'For some time past, you have been seeking David as king over you. Now then, bring it about. For the Lord has promised David, saying, By the hand of my servant David, I will save my people Israel from the hand of the Philistines and from the hand of their enemies.'" And remember, David, when he was Saul's commander, has got a reputation in all Israel of being a very successful warrior. So this is not an idle boast. Abner also spoke to Benjamin, and then Abner went to tell David at Hebron all that Israel and the whole house of Benjamin thought good to do. Then Abner came with 20 men to David at Hebron. David made a feast for Abner and the men who were with him. And Abner said to David, I will arise and go and will gather all Israel to my lord the king, that they may make a covenant with you, and that you may reign over all your heart desires. So David sent Abner away, and he went in peace. So Abner has given up the charade that Ishbosheth has got any claim on the throne. And he's the force behind Ishbosheth. He can make it happen. Verse 22. Just then the servants of David arrived with Joab from a raid, bringing much spoil with them. But Abner was not with David at Hebron, for he had sent him away, and he had gone in peace. Then Joab and all the army that was with him came. It was told Joab, Abner the son of Ner came to the king, and he has let him go, and he has gone in peace. When Joab went to the king, he said, What have you done? Behold, Abner came to you. Why is it you have sent him away, so that he is gone? You know that Abner the son of Ner came to deceive you, and to know you're going out and you're coming in, and to know all that you are doing. So Joab is a very political animal, and the last thing he wants is an arrangement between Abner and David where he, Joab, will at best have to share power. So obviously he says Abner's not sincere, he's just a spy. 26. When Joab came out from David's presence, he sent messengers after Abner, and they brought him back from the cistern of Sherah. But David did not know about it. And when Abner returned to Hebron, Joab took him aside into the midst of the gate to speak with him privately. And there he struck him in the stomach so that he died for the blood of Ashiel, his brother. What's going on is Hebron is a city of refuge. So Joab takes Abner outside the gate. So now, as the avenger of blood, he can strike Abner down for the death of his brother. That's what's going on here. And the key there is, he says, come on, let's go talk privately. And they walk outside the gate. And once they're outside of the gates, Joab turns and sticks him. 28. Afterward, when David heard of it, he said, I and my kingdom are forever guiltless before the Lord for the blood of Abner, the son of Ner. Again, political move. Because Abner is popular in the north. So if word gets out that David has arranged killing him, that is not going to be good. 29. May it fall upon the head of Joab and upon all his father's house. May the house of Joab never be without one who has a discharge, or who is leprous, or who holds a spindle, or who falls by the sword, or who lacks bread. So Joab and Abishai, his brother, killed Abner because he had put their brother Ashiel to death at the battle of Gibeon. Then David said to Joab and to all the people who were with him, tear your clothes and put on sackcloth and mourn before Abner. And King David followed the bier. They buried Abner in Hebron, and the king lifted up his voice and wept at the grave of Abner, and all the people wept. And the king lamented for Abner, saying, should Abner die as a fool dies? Ding, 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 ding. In other words, Abner didn't read the political situation right. He didn't realize Joab's character and Joab's murderous intent, so he foolishly walked out of the gate with Abner. So should Abner die as a fool dies? If he'd stayed in town, he would be fine. Your hands were not bound and your feet were not fettered. As one falls before the wicked, you have fallen. Obviously, he clearly does not approve, and he's letting everybody know that he does not approve. And all the people wept again over him. Then all the people came to persuade David to eat bread while it was yet day. But David swore, saying, God do so to me and more, if I taste bread or anything else, till the sun goes down. So he's putting on a big show of mourning Abner. And don't get me wrong, I am not saying that he's not sincere. I'm simply saying that it is all astutely political. 36. And all the people took notice of it, and it pleased them, as everything that the king did pleased all the people. So I say he's a natural-born politician. So all the people and all Israel understood that day that it had not been the king's will to put to death Abner the son of Ner. And the king said to his servants, "Do you not know that a prince and a great man has fallen this day in Israel? And I was gentle today, though anointed king. These men, the sons of Zeruiah, are more severe than I. The Lord repay the evildoer according to his wickedness." So the sons of Zeruiah are Joab and Abishai, and Ashiel, who is dead. And one of the things that David will say to Solomon when he commissions a hit on Joab, he will say that Joab shed the blood of war in time of peace. The whole idea here was the death of Ashiel was not a murder. It was part of a battle. He was a casualty, sorry about that, but the guy that killed him is not a murderer. He is a combatant. And Joab is taking vengeance in time of peace for blood shed in time of war. I believe that's what David says to Solomon, 1 Kings 2, as he's getting ready to die. So David does not approve. And by the way, I'm sure the disapproval is legitimate. He really doesn't approve. But he is going through all of this ceremonial stuff to make sure that all and sundry know he did not order this. He doesn't approve it. So we'll get rid of Ishbosheth next week. Let me take a minute. Your comment was that there are a couple of harlots in the line of Yeshua. You've got Bathsheba, and God lays it at David's feet, but I am sort of the opinion that it was sort of like a Monica Lewinsky thing, where she was showing herself off, and then you have Rahab the harlot. And your comment that you have two harlots in the line of Yeshua is absolutely perfect, because the whole human race is harlot to God. I'm very serious. It's a good comment. So the idea that you would have some actual harlots in the line of the Messiah is absolutely fitting, I think. Good comment.